Good. Let the sport commence.
You cannot just arrest him. You must find a different way. You may have to kill him. Does this discourage you?
You live well, Scaramanga.
As $1 million a contract, I can afford to, Mr. Bond. You work for peanuts. A hearty well done from Her Majesty the Queen and a pittance of a pension. Apart from that, we are the same.
The West is decadent and divided. It has no stomach to risk our atomic reprisals.
Is this the stupid mother that tailed you uptown?
There seems to be some mistake. My name is...
James is for tombstones, baby. You'll take this honky out and waste him, now.
You have a nasty habit of surviving.
Your power exists to serve me, and it is mine to control. If and when the time comes, I decide you are to lose it, I myself will take it away.
You see, Mr. Bond, like every great artist, I want to create an indisputable masterpiece once in my lifetime. The death of 007, mano a mano, face to face, will be mine. But it still remains the only true test for gentlemen.
I doubt if you qualify on that score.
To us, Mr. Bond, we are the best.
Hello and welcome to the next Odd Job Pod. My name is Gary Andrews. I will be your host as we continue our series in the Pod of Villainry. This one should be released a lot quicker than the last one was. So if our last podcast was one where MGM were battling for the rights, this is probably the one where the Bond team ill-advisedly rush out another film because the last one went quite really, really well. So this could well be our quantum of solace, potentially.
Oh, God, it's our man with the golden gun.
It's our Moonraker. Yep.
Tomorrow never dies.
Yep.
Oh, dear Lord, we've really set expectations high, haven't we?
Yeah, we
joining
have.
Me as ever.
No, really, joining me as ever. Is well worth it.
It will be completely worth it. We haven't even managed to get the introductions and we're already in a bad place. So joining me as ever is Terry DeFellin and Graham Sibley. And chaps, how are you feeling about now you know where this pod sits in the Odd Job Pod canon?
Oh yeah, I'm feeling great. I feel like Britt Eklund.
Yeah, you don't look like her.
Thankfully, not even in this fetching blue bikini.
I did ask you to put something on, but it is warm in here. In fairness,
if this was if Roger Moore was still with us, he'd be raising an eyebrow. Which this seems like a good a place as any to talk about the remaining Moore villains that haven't yet crossed our paths. So there is Dr. Kananga, or Mr. Big, played by Yaphet Kotto in Live and Let Die. Francisco Scaramanga, played by Christopher Lee in The Man with the Golden Gun. Aristarthel Christatus, played by Julian Glover in For Your Eyes Only. And then there is Octopussy, where Louis Jourdan, playing Kamal Khan, and we might chuck in a little bit of Stephen Berkoff and General Orlov, because frankly, I don't think there's any podcast or any Bond film that wouldn't have benefited from a bit of General Orlov in there. And you know what? Should we just start there? Because in the last pod, we started with the double villain handoff of Whittaker and Koskov. And in many ways, Octopussy was sort of the forerunner of that, because you have the mad Russian general and the villain in there. Although you've got to say in this case, Kamal Khan is a fascinating villain. But let's just start off with a little bit of Stephen Berkoff and General Orlov, Terry, because he's a wonderful character, and Stephen Berkoff just brings a wonderful Stephen Berkoffness to the role.
He plays him with absolute relish, doesn't he? Mm. He absolutely loves it. He's an extremely demonstrative actor, and he's well suited to these kind of roles. I mean, I'm sure we've seen him on TV as well, where he's played sort of a somewhat villainous role, and they're always really very expressive and quite menacing. There's a particularly good episode of Deep Space Nine that he's in, where he plays an arms dealer.
I'm sure everyone's very familiar with it.
And he's at, I can't remember the name of the episode, which is uncharacteristic for me, but I can't remember the name of the episode. But he plays an arms dealer. It's a later episode, and he's absolutely superb. I saw him play in a play called Kvetch years ago with Anita Dobson, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Mrs. Brian May.
Yes.
Yes.
The very same. Mm. Yeah. And yes, he didn't play a villain, but he was suitably Burkhoffian in his approach. It's almost as, I don't know whether or not the character of General Orloff was written for Stephen Burkhoff. I suspect not. He seems to be a fairly out of the box mad Russian general to me, of the kind that we've seen before and we'll see again. It's one that, you know, you looked at them and thought, you know, Burkhoff should play this, and they probably gave it to him and went, yes, I agree, I should totally play this role. He's got tremendous zeal, he's driven ideologically, of course. Plays off nicely against Kamal Khan, because Kamal Khan is in it for the wedge,
yes.
Whereas Orloff is in it for the greater glory of the Soviet Union, and indeed for himself.
Yes.
There's a wonderful, just so much wonderful scenery chewing that goes on whenever he's on screen. And of course, Graham as well. I actually, you know, for all the fact that Bond doesn't really sort of do, yeah, there's many things that Bond doesn't do particularly well, but villain deaths are obviously normally one of the better things. But I actually quite like the way that General Orloff meets his end in Octopussy. Sort of almost feels like it's the passing of an era when you've got Orloff mowed down by his own side.
Yeah, it is a wonderfully ordinary death as well for him. To be shot in the back.
Shot in the back, yeah. Almost in the gutter. I mean, it's on a railway line, but it's, you know,
but
it's an
on a railway siding, you know, the serial killer's dumping ground of choice.
Yeah, it is. It's an incredibly undignified death, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it is. It's a cheap death for him, and it's it is lovely. And considering that a lot of the other parts of the film are quite ridiculous, it's actually very down to earth. But it's
an odd fusion, isn't it, Octopussy?
A fusion is a wonderful, wonderful way to describe it. Yes,
it wants to be outlandish James Bond hijinks caper.
Yeah,
and it also wants to be, you know, gritty, down to earth Cold War thriller.
Well, you can see when they made it, this is going up against another Bond film.
Yes,
and so they really do try and say, "Hey, look, we're not just remaking an old one. We've got something that is truly 80s. This is of its time.
We've got Roger Moore in a clown suit, mate.
Got Roger Moore in a khaki suit.
Yeah, we got Roger Moore defusing a nuclear bomb in a clown suit.
Peak Roger, as we know, you know, as discussed.
It's the sum of all 80s fears, isn't it? Clowns and nuclear warfare, isn't it?
Well, of course, while you've obviously got an ordinary death for Stephen Burkhoff's character of General Orloff, obviously Louis Jourdan's Kamal Khan meets a much more befitting death of a villain after a quite wonderful set piece at the end on Octopussy. And Terry, I mean, Kamal Khan is a really fascinating villain. And yes, Octopussy has many problems, as it does when they send James Bond to various countries and they play riff off cultural stereotypes. But Kamal Khan is where does he stand for you in terms of villainry? Because he's to me, he's both has a mixture of both occasionally being over the top, but also very understated and very menacing at the same time.
He is one of the great classic traditional James Bond villains,
yeah,
where he's got the organisation, he's got the setup, he has almost full control of everything that goes within his path is in almost complete control, with two exceptions. One is obviously James Bond, who keeps beats him at backgammon and also foils his plans. And also there's Octopussy as well, which is the other element in there, which we're slightly misdirected into thinking she might be a villain in this movie, but obviously that's not quite how it goes out. Well, she's a jewel thief, so...
Yeah.
He's got the Nehru jacket look looking really, really good. And yeah, I mean, Louis Jourdan, really, he does downplay it. He's not quite that got so maniacal, but he ranks up the charm while at the same time being obviously very cold and very brutal, very violent, you know, employs violent people to do violent things, and does it with a really good coldness of touch. But he's charming as well. He's a proper traditional James Bond villain, somewhat anachronistic these days.
Yeah.
He wouldn't make a movie, and Kamal Khan would not be a suitable villain. More than anything else, he's a Frenchman playing an Afghan. That would not be something that you would do now, and quite rightly so. But, I mean, for the time, he was a proper Bond villain for me.
Yeah. I look at Kamal Khan and I think if Roger Moore ever played a Bond villain, it would be Kamal Khan. It would that's Louis Jourdan and Roger Moore, I think they're very similar. I think I look at Louis Jourdan and think he's the French Roger Moore, isn't he?
I reckon Louis Jourdan has probably appeared or possibly starred in a few European James Bond rip-off movies from the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah,
I reckon if we had a good look at had a rummage around the bargain basement bins in European DVD shops, assuming they still exist, we might unearth a few gems.
Yeah, I bet if you'd gone down to Le Bookmakers during the 1970s, they would have always had really short odds of him being the next Bond.
Yeah,
absolutely. Far shorter than you'd find in London or anywhere else.
Yeah, they'd be astonished when they find it.
What? Why? He's perfect for the role. Why the hell haven't they not given it to him?
Stupid English.
Sacrebleu. There's one thing as well that I think Kamal Khan, because obviously you've got that understated, in control, sophisticated, but not, you know, unlike, say, other villains where there is that kind of physical feature or whatever that's sort of, you know, or there's that really obvious outward villainry. When you've got a villain, for me, like Kamal Khan, they've got to have a fantastic henchman. And for me, I think Kabir Bedi is a fantastic henchman. Gobinda is just a really... quite terrifying, actually, in a way. And the two of them make a wonderful double act, which actually, when you look at the kind of the henchman to boss villain relationship, actually, I think, you know, the relationship between Kamal Khan and Gobinda is probably, for me, Terry, one of my favourite sort of henchman supervillain relationships.
Well, yeah, I mean, because they just they play. There's tremendous chemistry between those two. The well, obviously in the climax, they go out and get it. Go. And but for me, the best part is when they're getting in the car, having just dropped off the bomb, and they're getting in their Mercedes to drive off, and Gobinda turns over the car and it won't start, and then there's this just a brief moment. And then they're off, and they're good. And there's some really lovely little comic moments, little vignettes in that movie, and yeah, there's tremendous chemistry between those two actors. Even though in many ways the portrayal of India and Indians in this movie is offensive, they did bring in, you know, some pretty, you know, talented people to play those roles. I mean, you've got to mitigate that kind of, you know, general offensive colonial attitude towards India against the fact that, you know, they you know, on the production side of things, they kind of knew what they were doing.
Yeah. There was a bit of a spate of Indian films around that time, because obviously Gandhi was one of the biggest films, but Passage to India as well, and on telly as well, you had things like The Far Pavilions and things like that. So there was lots of India inspired.
Yeah, Jewel in the Crown as well.
Yeah, Jewel in the Crown, things like that. So you've got things that were inspired by the Days of the Raj.
Yeah,
so.
James Bond ripping off contemporary culture again.
Again.
Yeah, bloody psychopaths.
Well, if we're going to talk about ripping off contemporary culture, do we feel that we've covered Kamal Khan and all of in detail? Because if we do, I think there's another big rip off of contemporary culture that sits very, very large in this pantheon of Moore films, and that is Live and Let Die, and that is Yaphet Kotto as Dr. Kananga, or Mr. Big. And that really is, I mean, we talk about sort of Bond being ear of the time, and this was the point, Graham, where they basically went, right, we've got a new actor in, and let's make Bond relevant. Great, blaxploitation's big, let's do one of them.
Yeah. Now, regular listeners of this podcast will know how much we love this film.
Mm.
We did the DVD commentary. That was our first DVD commentary. We've only done two. But the first one we chose, the first one, I think we were pretty much unanimous in saying, let's do Live and Let Die.
Yeah.
Because we have a great affection for it.
Yeah.
Despite, what you said about Octopussy, it being a bit flawed and
problematic.
Problematic
is the word.
Live and Let Die is probably, well, it's got to be up there, top three problematic films, really.
Yeah. It gets a pass because people say, oh, yes, it's a James Bond's take on the blaxploitation movies.
Yeah.
And so therefore, it gets a pass in that respect.
Yeah.
Apart from, well, anyway.
Yeah. It is. But it is what it is. And of course, I mean, we've never shied away from saying that Bond is as racist as a grandparent. But we still love our grandparents, despite the fact that they can be a little out of touch. And I think with really a film coming up to 50 years old, it can be a little bit out of touch, I suppose.
Mm.
Because, doesn't mean we forgive it. And we look at it and we
well, we watch it though.
Yeah. But that said, Yaphet Kotto in this film is brilliant.
Yes.
Well, Yaphet Kotto in a film is brilliant.
Yaphet Kotto in any movie is always a wise move.
Yeah.
And he relishes the role again, as you always have to. And of course, because he plays two roles initially, doesn't he? He plays this Mr. Big character with the not entirely convincing prosthetics.
HD is not his friend.
HD's definitely not his friend, no. but I mean, HD reveals all manner of stuff on those Bond movies.
Yeah, it does. Man,
lots of nipple as well. Oh my God, there's some nipple there. I didn't realise that was there. Anyway, that's aside. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of going back to what we were talking about with Octopussy, is that, yes, where they let themselves down in terms of narrative and storyline and portrayal of races and minorities and ethnic groups, you know, you mitigate by the fact that they do bring in good people to play these roles. And Yaphet Kotto is among the best.
Yeah.
And I think he is in terms in contemporary sort of like 1970s, early 70s kind of form, he is a modern villain. Because we're watching these kind of blaxploitation movies, and we're used to seeing those kind of characters, and so he fits in with that kind of zeitgeist, for want of a better word. But I mean, there's also work done to he works well to make certain that he is a proper Bond villain. He does the whole I've been expecting you, Mr. Bond, kind of thing. But there is that kind of also hardness and toughness, particularly in those scenes with Solitaire, which are genuinely uncomfortable. I've always been very uncomfortable with that scene with Solitaire where he knows that she's betrayed him and then deliberately lures her into taking steps to betray him when he knows full well. And then, he assaults her, and it's very uncomfortable and very, very effective as well. And sets him apart as being an absolute classic villain.
Yeah, and of course he comes up with the perfect hit back to the mind is Bond, James Bond, doesn't he? That really sets him out as I'm not your normal villain, mate.
Yeah, names is for tombstones, baby.
which is one of the classic lines of any Bond film, and probably
of
really,
any film.
Yeah, of any film.
It is a great comeback, and a one time only use. You're never going to get to use that again.
Exactly. Yeah, no one's ever going to get away with using that one again.
Names is for tombstones, baby.
And you've got to say, if we talked about the wonderful chemistry in Octopussy between the villain and the henchman, that any time you've got Yaphet Kotto and Roger Moore on screen together, it's just a real joy to watch two very different actors, different styles. But there's something about having those two play off against each other which really, really works. And for me, is one of the great joys of Live and Let Die. And it's always a great joy in a Bond film when you have got a couple of, when you've got a great sparring between Bond and the villain, and the two just work together with the terms of chemistry. This, Terry, it totally works in terms of chemistry.
So that scene with Kananga, who has captured Bond, Solitaire is reading the cards wrongly, and the way that whole sequence was set up, And I remember when we did the commentary, we talked about that scene and just the set of the direction of it also as well. And I mean, that's one of those scenes in the movie that genuinely makes that movie. That chemistry that you're talking about working really, really well there, you know, and this suppressed anger and from Kananga and Roger Moore trying to maintain this cool exterior while knowing that the jig must be up.
Yeah, and his pinky's on the line.
And his pinky's on the line, and indeed, you know, other parts as well, other areas as well. And still trying to just be desperately trying to keep the advantage for as long as conceivably possible. It's an excellent scene.
Mm. Yeah, it is brilliant. I think, obviously, Roger Moore is much maligned for his acting range. Unfairly, in my point of view, but you know, everyone has the right to their own opinion as far as this is concerned. But when you see him go, the type of actors he goes up against, and yes, a lot of the time the actors act in a completely different way. They've got a different approach to acting. And so the on-screen thing between them can be a little jarring, but there is still chemistry there. There's been chemistry with Bond, with Moore's Bond, with all of his adversaries.
Yeah, I mean, it's very different when you would say put George Lazenby up against Telly Savalas.
Exactly, and we spoke about this in the one we did recently about
Secret Service.
And about the difficulty they have, and the fact that when you want that chemistry only really comes around when it's Diana Rigg and Telly Savalas. In many ways, Diana Rigg is the Bond in that film.
Yeah, I mean, Roger Moore was, I mean, yes, again, you're right about his range, but he knew how to act. He was a professional actor. He'd learnt the trade, he'd learnt the craft.
And it's not as if he hadn't gone up against big hitters before.
Exactly.
Or people with...
Certainly.
Perhaps not people with who you would think are astounding actors, but people who have great screen presence. This is a guy who worked with Tony Curtis, and Tony Curtis wasn't the best actor in the world.
But also remember,
he had great screen presence.
He made about 5 million episodes of The Saint.
Yeah.
And almost all of those episodes usually were all featured, you know, well-established actors.
Yeah.
Usually from rep. Even the ones that weren't well-known guest stars, and there were plenty of well-known guest stars on there, but even the ones that weren't were all from rep.
Yeah.
And they all did the circuit, and they all knew the craft. It's not something that you get, if you're not a good actor, you're going to get found out pretty quickly, and you wouldn't be making as many episodes.
And he used all that experience.
And he took all of that with him. Whereas George Lazenby was a clothes horse.
Yeah.
I mean, I love him, but he was a clothes horse.
Yeah.
He would have developed into a great Bond, I'm certain of it. You know, he was not an experienced actor. He couldn't bring that with him.
No, and
even the Zorin pieces, you know, the most critical I usually am of Moore is with the Zorin stuff, whereas I think Chris Walken just, like, dominates him.
Yeah.
But I think that's the only occasion where, you know, I think where Moore seems to struggle.
I think you're right there, because, I mean, you look at people like, the people he goes up against, like Berkoff, Julian Glover, very much in the English style, but different, entirely different approaches to acting. And then you've got Yaphet Kotto, and then you've got... Christopher Walken.
Yeah. And Kurt Jurgens and Michael Lonsdale, who come from entirely different schools.
Yeah.
And he's comfortable with all
and
of these guys.
And of course, Christopher Lee.
And of course, Christopher Lee, which we're going to be talking about momentarily, I think. Yes.
Well, shall we move on?
Shall we?
I think we've all agreed how much we are a great appreciator of Yaphet Kotto and Kananga and Mr. Big, because how much we love Live and Let Die. Obviously, you'll know that if you've gone back and listened to our DVD commentary, and that he has all the elements of being a brilliant Bond villain. As you say, you have Roger Moore going up against Christopher Lee, who, again, is another one of those actors that if he had never made it into a Bond film as a villain, you'd have been asking, well, why the hell hasn't he been in a Bond film as a villain? The Man with the Golden Gun may have been rushed out. It probably is not one of the finest Bond films, although I retain an affection for it, because it's certainly one of the first ones I remember watching. You have Christopher Lee, who is a quite wonderful actor, and obviously somebody who comes from, when you talk about the various traditions, Christopher Lee obviously coming from a cinematic tradition where he's playing not just a screen villain, but a classic bogeyman as well.
Yeah, certainly. I think you from what we were saying in the previous pod about the villains not being remembered because they weren't in a great film, Christopher Lee turns this on his head because he dominates this film. And he is the most, apart from perhaps Knick-Knack, he is the one of the only memorable things out of this film, because he's brilliant in it.
Mm.
And he gets all the best lines. Mm-hmm. He gets all the best scenes. And, you know, he is just generally fantastic.
He always did like that mausoleum.
Put him in it. Yes. It's a brilliant line. Brilliant line.
Yeah, I mean, I think Scaramanga is another contemporary of Bond, isn't he? He's the kind of guy that Bond could have been if Bond hadn't entered into the service.
And the thing is that Scaramanga always points that out to him as well. And that's what really angers Bond. And this is obviously one of the best scenes in Roger Moore's run as Bond. But it's also one of the best scenes in any Bond film. Mm. It's the bit when they're sat down to dinner.
Yes,
and dinner. It's the one that Steve Coogan on the trip. What's the other guy?
Rob Brydon,
yeah. And they always do it, don't they? That one scene. And they love it. It's like,
yes.
Come now, Mr. Bond, you enjoy killing everybody as much as I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is fabulous. It sticks in your head, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the cut down of the true test of a gentleman, hardly you think you qualify in that style. I can't remember the exact line. But it's very personal. And it's also an opportunity because the Roger Moore's veneer, Moore's Bond's veneer drops somewhat.
Yeah,
James Bond is Roger Moore's James Bond is a classic example of this, of the sort of like infamous politeness of the English gentleman, which is the steel fist in a velvet glove. unflinchingly polite and yet absolutely ruthless and implacably opposed to you. Jacob Rees-Mogg is the perfect example of this guy. Unfailingly polite, but will happily sell your grandmother. If it was to meet his political ideals.
Obviously played up to great effect by Colin Firth in the Kingsman movies, especially the first one, where manners maketh a man.
Absolutely.
But then proceeding to beat seven shades out of a local hoodlums in a pub.
This is exactly right. And this is Roger Moore's Bond.
Yeah.
And that's why it's always important not to underestimate his performances as James Bond. And that in their own way they are brutal and savage. It's just he carries that English gentleman veneer about him.
Christopher Lee as well. I mean, as Graham, as we've said, the man with the golden gun is despite all the facts I have of an affection for it, it's not a great Bond film. It's really not one of the best ones in there. And yet it's to me, it has a similarity to an extent with the last film that Moore did, which was A View to a Kill, whereby actually it's a film which is... it would be perhaps a little bit of a tedious watch if it wasn't for the lead villain. And the lead villain, just like Christopher Walken, sort of hams it up and just completely does the film. There's something that's just wonderfully well written about... Everything about Scaramanga, to me, is meant to be in the Bond film. It's almost as if they couldn't find the right film for Scaramanga, and it was just... the film was sort of written around him, but they couldn't get the right sort of film, as opposed to some films where it's very well balanced. This is a film which is a villain that's crying out for a better film than the one that he's in.
It's almost as if Scaramanga is actually crying out for a story arc. It's almost as if Scaramanga would have been great if the seeds for him had been sown in the three previous films or something like that, where you've got someone who is out of reach, someone picking people off, and then you come to this head-to-head. When this head-to-head comes, it's like you receive a bullet in the post, and that's it. That's the first you hear of him, this guy. It is almost like Scaramanga really comes under this arch of has Bond met his match. This is ever since Grant in From Russia with Love. This is his peer. This is someone who has got all of Bond's attributes. Apart from the fact that Bond is a gentleman, and that's what sets him apart from the Oi Polloi,
Well, I think also, I mean, it's interesting because the book Man with a Golden Gun was not really complete. It was Fleming's last novel,
right?
And it wasn't really finished. It was published posthumously, I think, and not entirely complete. I mean, it was, but it wasn't. I mean, the feeling,
like, consideration was
that it was an early draft, and then actually, you know, by this point, he was kind of weary of the character, I think, anyway, yeah. And he was kind of writing it, not under duress, but perhaps because he felt his public demanded it. And it's a shame because it's a bit like that with the movie, because although the movie isn't half finished, it's certainly half cocked. Yeah. You know, it's not an entirely thought through movie.
Half cocked, you say?
It sort of shares that kind of heritage as well. The character. I mean, Christopher Lee, I think, also relishes the fact that he's not playing Dracula,
or he's which he was doing a hell of a lot in the 70s.
Because all he was doing was playing, you know, various different hues on the Dracula. Doing, I mean, he's a ubiquitous, though, not ubiquitous, incredibly famous actor at the time. I mean, really, a global superstar, albeit typecast, famous for really only playing Dracula. And to a lesser extent, he also played Frankenstein's monster in the first Hammer Frankenstein movie. Yeah. Which, by the way, if you like classic horror movies, do check that movie out if you haven't seen it before. It's really good. Everyone thinks about the Frankenstein movies as the Boris Karloff, but in many ways, Christopher Lee's interpretation of the monster is as compelling as Karloff's.
I have to ask the question when everyone brings up Hammer film. Is that the one with Ralph Bates in it?
No, it's not the one with Ralph Bates. It's the one with Christopher Lee in it. Peter Cushing. It's called Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed.
Yes.
And it sounds like a sequel, but it's not. Because Hammer had all manner of problems making this movie because of Warner Brothers were like going, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah. Well, they actually, Universal had actually copyrighted the makeup, hadn't they? So they couldn't even make him look like Frankenstein.
Which is great, because I mean, it works really, really well. And the unveiling of the monster is also brilliant. It's a wonderful, wonderful film. Anyway. The idea of him then being able to be played, we want you to play a Bond villain, you know, it's still a villain, but, you know, there's more nuance to the character, you're not wearing makeup, you don't have fangs, you know,
you have
dialogue.
Have an extra nipple.
Yeah, you've got an extra nipple, but, you know, I mean, he carries it off quite well.
Yeah.
He genuinely relishes the role. He's absolutely loving it. And it is a real shame because, I mean, both the character and the actor deserved better. And it's a shame that they killed the character off. And it's a shame that they did, you know, these kind of anthology-style things because, I mean, you're right, Graham. Mm. You know, he deserved an arc. If they reboot the franchise again, who knows?
Mm.
Maybe they'll bring him back.
Yes.
They could do worse.
Certainly.
I was actually, as you were talking of that, my mind started wandering in a slightly tangential way off to Dracula Dead and Loving It and Young Frankenstein, which is Mel Brooks, which is obviously a very different way, but no less enjoyable
that's a completely
many
different podcast.
It is, isn't it?
Yes,
and I could quite happily do an entire podcast on Mel Brooks movies without any problem whatsoever. But there's a couple of interesting things from you, Christopher Lee. One, I believe he was actually related to Ian Fleming in some way. I think he was his first cousin. Cousin of Ian Fleming, which I think is quite interesting because one would imagine that there would be certainly a level of responsibility that you'd feel certainly as not just an actor but as a relative of Ian Fleming when you're in there. And the second thing is just when I was thinking back between you kind of mentioned From Russia with Love, and actually I think Christopher Lee, when in his performance, he brings a menace to the screen, which I don't think any villain has had really done since Robert Shaw.
Yeah.
I really couldn't think of anybody who had quite that level of menace. And again, that level of menace doesn't really crop up. Probably, I don't know where you get the next sort of heavy level of menace, because you've got a lot of over-the-topness. Potentially Roberto Davi might be the next one who has that sort of really, really heavy, menacing attitude to it, but even then, probably doesn't really hold a candle to either Lee or Shaw.
Yeah, I don't think you get it in the Moore era at all.
No, I don't think so. No, they're a little bit too soft, aren't they, around the edges?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've
a bit
got
more polished, aren't
they? Yeah, you've got Zorin, but that's not really.
Yeah,
that's not really menace. That because you know these. This guy's clearly nuts.
Yes, yeah, but he and he's sort of quite charming as well in his nuttiness. I am a big fan of Adolfo Celli, Emil Largo, in Thunderball. I think he's a massively under because I think the movie is so tedious and boring to watch.
Yes, people
forget about the times when he's very good. I would when we come to do him. Yeah. I would urge you guys to maybe revisit that character because you might
means
find
have to revisit the film. Though.
It does mean you have to revisit the movie, which is a shame because it is a bit of a chore. Have a couple of whiskies or something like that.
Yeah, that sounds a good idea.
Yeah.
So I think there's obviously with us an awful lot of love for Christopher Lee in there, and so there's clearly lots more that we could say about it, but we'll move it on to the final film, and I don't know quite how much we're going to have to say about the final one, but I suspect we'll probably find a fair bit if we want to, which is Christatos, played by Julian Glover in For Your Eyes Only. The first gut feeling you have when you start talking about For Your Eyes Only and Christatos, and whilst I don't necessarily put For Your Eyes Only down as the worst Bond movie, but in terms of villains, I guess, Graham, one of the biggest problems is that Christatos is just incredibly forgettable.
Ooh,
and
yeah.
Coming into this, I'm really... There's many moments I can remember from For Your Eyes Only, but there's very little that kind of immediately springs to mind when you talk about Christatos, which is a shame because Julian Glover is a brilliant actor.
Well, he's introduced in the film as not a villain, isn't he? Really, it's something that emerges throughout it. But unfortunately, you don't really get past that fact that he's not really someone. Mm. Obviously, he's not got webbed fingers or metal hands or something like that. So there's nothing obvious villainous about him.
Mm.
But yeah, it is a forgettable film, isn't it? So he is a forgettable person.
It's difficult
because Julian Glover was a fine actor and was in lots of things. But and you know his assault on the Hoth will go down, won't it?
Indeed,
was brilliant. Fantastically, yes.
The shield will be down in moments.
Yes.
You may start your landing.
Yes.
I think that the Greek accent really didn't help him at all.
Yeah.
I thought that was a big error in judgment there. I think actually you could have done better maybe by swapping him and Topol round and maybe putting Topol in the Christatos role. I think he might have actually pulled that off better
having
Christatos as the ally.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
I don't think he was helped also because I don't think he was very real written. And there was no particular great reveal about him being the bad guy. It was done when he was off screen, and he might have benefited from perhaps a bit more screen time, where we had an opportunity to see him being, you know, maybe it would have been good to have had that reveal. And really, the only time we ever got to see him doing anything truly villainous was in the was when they strapped Bond up and tried to keelhaul him, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, that was pretty villainous. But I mean, he just lacked commitment,
sure.
I think, you know.
And it's done in too nice a place. You're in the Greek islands. It's gorgeous there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very tough place to it's not exactly a railway line, you know, in Eastern Europe.
No, you're not selling grit. This is why he wasn't in the gritty
this
one.
This is why this is totally why he wasn't in the gritty one.
I guess, Terry, for me, one of the biggest problems that I've got with Christatos, and this is when you look at the other villain and the list of villainry, is that when you kind of try and put a description against him, it comes back to that classic, film rating, which is Christatos contains mild peril.
Yes, that's extremely well put, Gary. He does indeed. Yeah, I mean, as I said, there's a lack of conviction in the character. I think, unfortunately, which is a tremendous shame because, as you say, Graham, Julian Glover was a magnificent actor and in a different role in a different movie would have made a fantastic James Bond villain. Mm. But sadly, yes, I think there was a desire to change the franchise. Of course, as we know, it was the one that came after Moonraker where they'd sent him into space. And I think that there was an understandable desire to nail things back down somewhat, make it a bit more Cold War, make it a bit more spy-like and try and make the villains a little bit more authentic to that particular genre rather than authentic to the James Bond genre, which by this point it really is a full-fledged genre in itself. And I don't think it stuck to enough rules. There's got to be rules with James Bond villains. Even, you know, the contemporary villains have certain rules that they stick to, the good ones. And the ones that don't are the ones that tend to be the ones that you don't remember. And I'm afraid that Christatos doesn't stick to any of those. There's no, you know, the facial disfigurement or, you know, something like that. They have these characteristics that make up a James Bond film that endure right from the very beginning of the franchise all the way up to the now. You know, you have to stick to those, to some of those rules at least, and unfortunately that doesn't happen. And it's not Julian Glover's fault. He is was a magnificent actor.
Yep.
I mean, the one thing, you know, the thing that I I remember most about Furiosone is probably the Citroen 2 CV chase, which is probably one of my favourite bits of the film. The villainry isn't in.
It's got a cracking ski chase. And I can't remember the guy's name, sadly, but the guy who played Leopold Locke in the kind of henchman guy who Bond ends up killing by kicking him off that cliff. He is really good, but has no dialogue. There is some genuine quality in this movie. There's more just than the Tizzy V chase, in my opinion. That ski chase is superb. And in fact, actually, the mountaineering piece, the rock climbing at the end, I mean, that's great stunt work. Fantastic stunt work.
Oh, yeah.
There's the build quality on these movies is always really, really fantastic. but it lacks balance, and the whole BB thing is just too creepy for words. And it's difficult. It's uncomfortable to watch parts of that movie, and it's one of the reasons why I watch it. It's one of my most least watched movies, and Thunderball, I'd say.
It does have problems all the way through it.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's difficult because sometimes you see a Bond film that doesn't work out very well, and you think, well, actually, I can see where they were going for with this one. You can see that if they just did something slightly different, or if you go to even something like Die Another Day, you can see a turning point where it was fine up until this point, and then all of a sudden it just becomes toilet.
It becomes another movie.
Yeah, basically. But with Furiosone, you don't get that. It's just so. Oh, well, after the previous two, I mean, we all know, Moonraker was completely over the top. And many would say, well, that had a turning point in it. They went into space. Yes.
But they'd be right as well.
Yes. but that also forgets the fact that there was the hovercraft gondola and Plan B, which also... Yeah, okay, well, we're not talking about Moonraker. We're talking about this film. But I mean, after The Spy Who Loved Me, and then just two films later to come out with Your Eyes Only, it was a letdown, I think, really. It's an enjoyable film. I remember enjoying it at the time.
When I was a teenager,
I was easily pleased. It was the 80s, so.
But even down to the Bill Conti soundtrack, which, I mean, I actually these days quite enjoy. I like that soundtrack now, but in the past, when I was a very, very serious teenage James Bond fan, I was offended by that. I just thought it was just like garbage, sort of like crappy 80s wah-wah shit.
So in many ways, Julian Glover's character here, Christatos, really sums up the film as a whole.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, unspectacular.
Yeah, fails to obey its own rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, and lacks conviction.
There you go.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you one, probably, and this is might be one of the ultimate insults, because obviously I do heavy amounts of research before I come onto the pod, including looking at Wikipedia. But Christatos is one of only three Bond villains who does not have his own Wikipedia entry.
No.
Now, would you like to guess who the other two are?
Oh, my God. Are they ones we've actually discussed?
We've discussed them in the past.
Right.
Okay. Oh, but have we discussed them as part of this series of World Cup of Bond villains?
They have both been discussed as part of this World Cup of Bond.
So, Dominic Green?
Dominic, you are spot on. Dominic Green does not have his own Wikipedia entry, which is not a huge surprise.
No.
The other one is a big surprise.
Is it?
Koskov.
Mm. No, it's not Koskov. Koskov does have his own Wikipedia entry.
Is it General Orlov?
Well, General Orlov doesn't, and neither does Kamal Khan. Which is, I think, is...
That's
I know.
A hideous oversight.
If there are any Wikipedia admins listening...
I'll go in. I'll knock one up tomorrow.
Of course, because you can... Yeah, that's why it's called UGC. Yes, yeah. Okay, right. Well, I mean, at the time of listening...
Yeah.
He has no Wikipedia page.
Yeah, but prepare the listeners, because Kamal Khan's going to get one of the best Wikipedia pages now. And it's going to be full of crap.
Edit it wisely, Mr. Sibley.
Yes. Make sure you're dropping plenty of links for the Odd Job pod. Yeah. While you're at it.
Citation needed.
We are the citation. This is the ultimate James Bond citation podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. We are canon, aren't we?
We are indeed
the keeper of canon.
Yeah, we are indeed the keeper of canon. Yeah, and occasionally the loser of canon behind the fridge. Or, you know.
It's just makes it so canon it hurts.
It's a loose canon. Right.
Yes. So, I'll start with you, Graham. If you are ranking this set of Moore era villains from 1 to 4, how would you rank them, Lars?
Oh, this is really tricky. I mean, I can start with the bottom one easily. That's for starters. He's a long way bottom as well. Now it gets a bit more tricky, but it doesn't really get tricky, though, does it?
No, not really. No, you just don't want to say it out loud. That's all. You love these villains so much that you don't want to hurt them.
No,
by being unkind to them.
Well,
but you're not being unkind to them, because what you do is you preface it by saying there's a cigarette paper between the rest of them.
Yes, there is. But I think because all of them.
All of yeah.
Yeah. So it's all of is next. Even though he's great and he's brilliant, and by which name, by Kamal Khan comes in there next, and then you've got the top two, and how do you choose between Kananga and Scaramanga? I am gonna come out, even though I have great love for Live and Let Die, I think Scaramanga just pips it. Really, I think just because of the strength of the performance that Christopher Lee gives, and the fact that he is head and shoulders above anything else, literally above his henchmen, but head and shoulders above everything else in that film.
I'm going to have to concur with your with you as well. I think that Christatos comfortably the poorer of all of that group. Orlov is great, brilliant. Brilliantly acted by Berkoff, but one-dimensional, out of the box Russian, mad Russian general, I think that Kamal Khan is wonderfully presented at him. I have a lot of personal affection for him, but you've got in Yaphet Kotto and Christopher Lee, you've got two real heavyweight James Bond characters played by great actors, and that combination of the two just places them above Kamal Khan, I'm going to go with Christopher Lee because Christopher Lee.
Yes.
Yeah. And for probably no surprise for me that Christatos sits down at the bottom. I think that would be a surprise to nobody. And I think if you were kind of doing a full league table of Bond villains, he would probably still be down the bottom at the end of it. Yeah, and again, Orlov is paint by numbers mad Russian, but brilliant. I mean, it's never a bad thing to have Stephen Berkoff on screen at any given point in time. Then, yes, Kamal Khan as well. There's just something when you kind of look at Yaphet Kotto's Kananga and Scaramanga from Christopher Lee, they are both just on a completely separate level, and great as Kamal Khan is, wonderful as Octopus he is as a movie, he's just not on that level. And then when I get to the top, I am just, I actually slightly lean towards Kananga, just because I think Live and Let Die, Christopher Lee pretty much, you know, you could make an argument given that Christopher Lee carries the man with the golden gun, but there's something just about Kananga, and he's got some fantastic lines. His manner of death is quite horrific, but also brilliant as well. I mean, he's got a proper villain demise. But also there's just the way and the command in there. And no matter how problematic Live and Let Die is as a film, Kananga himself isn't problematic, because he sits just brilliantly as a villain, and he's so well played. And just the moment when he sort of really, the film comes alive when you've got him and Moore together, it's brilliant. And I but again, as you say, there is a cigarette paper between them. And I would just about plump for Yaphet Kotto over Christopher Lee, but that's a tough call to make by anybody's book.
Yeah, good for you, and well said. Yeah, well argued. I mean, indeed, it is at this point, it just simply becomes a question of personal preference, and not, you know, nothing to do with the mechanics of the role. It's and I'm sure our listeners will have their own things. There's probably a listener out there who is appalled at our opinion on Chris D'Artos.
Well, yeah, the person who's writing up his Wikipedia page right now.
Just like, tell right, okay, how quickly?
Yeah, reception. Chris D'Artos has been unfairly maligned by a number of sources, specifically
citation
for citation needed.
But see, that's the beauty of it, because we are probably the only podcast in the world that actually talks about Chris D'Artos.
Yes, we probably are. Well, do you know what? I'm pretty certain we're
not.
Oh,
God. Oh, no.
There are a lot of podcasts.
There are.
There are so many podcasts out there now. I know, I mean, like, we've been doing this for years.
Yeah.
But, like, it was all fields back then.
It was all fields back then.
You know, now it's like...
To be fair, where we are is still fields. So there's just a huge cities around us.
Yes. That's very true. Yeah, we are. We have taken ourselves out into the hinterlands, shall we say.
We've taken us to the point where Harrison Ford is in the second Blade Runner film.
Yes,
very much. Yes, there.
Vegas, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some destructed version of Vegas. I'd like to think it's we've gone to make our own podcasts with on Bond with blackjack and hookers. And that wasn't just the general misogyny. If you've not watched Futurama, then you've missed out.
Yeah, that's about the third episode. I think everyone's seen that one, haven't they? They know that reference.
Yeah, yeah,
everybody must have seen. If you haven't seen Futurama, then what the hell are you doing listening to this podcast?
You seem to be lost, kind stranger.
Yes.
The internet has obviously run out of signposts.
Back that way, mate. Back that way.
Did you just come from a Wikipedia citation on Kamal Khan by any chance?
Oh, we've become wonderfully meta, haven't we?
And it feels like a good enough point to bring this podcast to a close. We will be back with them. And it's the last set of villainry, isn't it? From this, I think we've gone full villain.
I'm not sure. I think we might have another two.
I think we might have to get a bargain basement of other ones.
Have we done Doctor No? We haven't done Largo. Have we done Grant?
I don't think so. We haven't done those early
Connery ones.
Yeah,
have we?
I think we've got those to go with.
So we've got those to go, and then we've got to clean up, and we've got some Pierce Brosnan.
I think we've got a few Pierce ones to do as well.
So I reckon we've got two more to do. So the next time we convene, we'll do those two as a back-to-back, I think. Two sets of podcasts as a back-to-back. And then
the respective Connery and Brosnan canons.
Yes, indeed. But there's some gold there, because, of course, we have got Joseph Weisman's Dr. No, which is a conversation... That is a conversation to be had.
That is going to be... When we were talking about our top three of problematic films...
Yes, that's Joseph Weisman's Chinese Dr. No.
Yeah.
Yep.
And on that, we'll leave you to wonder where that one may be going. But it just remains for me to say thank you very much to Graham Sibley and to Terry DeFellin. A pleasure as always, gentlemen.
Pleasure entirely mine.
And mine.
Yes. And thank you, dear listener, and please keep refreshing Wikipedia as you go. I've been Gary Andrews. The Odd Job Pod will return soon. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.